Once upon a time, computer scientist Alan Kay is reported to have said, quote, "The best way to predict the future is to invent it. Really smart people with reasonable funding can do just about anything that doesn't violate too many of Newton's laws." Well, this week, Kay and three other really smart people were awarded the Charles Stark Draper Prize by the National Academy of Engineering. That's a prize in the past that has gone to people responsible for things like the integrated circuit, the modern jet engine, fiber optics. It's sort of the Nobel Prize of Engineering. Charles Thacker, Butler Lampson, Robert Taylor, and Alan Kay all worked in one place. This is what they had in common, not only one place, but they worked at the legendary Palo Alto Research Center, or PARC, owned by Xerox, so it's called Xerox PARC. And that's a place where they develop many of the technologies that we take for granted in our computers today. And they received the award this week for developing the Alto. That is a really personal research computer that could fit in your office. It had a mouse, a graphical user interface, a what-you-see-is-what-you-get word processor, and could be connected together with other Altos using something called Ethernet. And they built this whole thing in the mid-1970s. Sound very familiar to what we're using today? Well, a young Steve Jobs taking a tour of the lab, he noticed this idea, and he brought the idea of this point-and-click computer system with him back to Apple Computer and turned it eventually into the Macintosh. And those years at Xerox were almost legendary for the work done by these technologists who literally invented the future. Not only did they invent the GUI and the point-and-click, but the concept of networking personal computers, gee, why don't we hook them together and do something? And they invented the laser printer. Xerox was the first to do that. And PARC people went on to create companies like Adobe and 3Com. And three of the PARC engineers, those pioneers, are here with us this hour. And if you'd like to talk to them, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. I'm not sure they've ever been on a radio program together. We'll find out. Let me introduce them. Alan Kay has been called by some of the father of the personal computer. He's been chief scientist of Atari, a fellow at Xerox, Apple, and Disney, and he's currently a senior fellow at Hewlett-Packard. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. Robert Taylor was the founder and manager of the Computer Science Laboratory at Xerox PARC from 1970 through 1983. Before joining Xerox, he worked at ARPA, funded the construction of ARPANET, which eventually led to the Internet, and he's with us today. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Ira. How you doing?
Hi, how are you? Charles Thacker constructed the first batch of Altos and was responsible for the hardware engineering side of the project, and he's now a distinguished engineer at Microsoft's Emerging Technology Group. Welcome to the program.
Morning, Ira.
Good morning. Butler Lampson, the fourth recipient, was the system architect for the Alto and created much of its operating system, but he's on a plane at the moment, and it's a little hard to reach him up there, up in the sky, but we want to congratulate him and wish him luck. Bob Taylor, you were the guy in charge of the computing science lab at PARC, and you recruited all these guys.
I was what, to all these guys?
Did you recruit all these guys?
Yes, I did.
How did that happen? Were you very lucky or very good?
He was good.
Well, you have to go back a ways. The people that I recruited were, before I recruited them, graduate students in computer science at a small number of universities that were funded by ARPA. Mm-hmm. And I was head of the ARPA computer funding organization for about 5 years prior to the opening of Xerox PARC, so I knew a lot of these folks when they were graduate students. Furthermore, the projects that ARPA was funding that these graduate students worked on were projects to try to develop for the first time interactive computing. So all of these people that I recruited had a common interest and a common background and a shared set of insights about what interactive computing meant and how to design it and build it, which set them apart from most other people that were involved with computers in those days.
In fact, in 1968, you wrote a paper with J.C.R. Licklider called The Computer as a Communication Device.
Yes.
It was a foreign concept that you would hook up all these computers together, was it not?
I'm sorry.
It was a foreign concept in those days.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I was not only foreign, I would say that it was pretty heavily condemned as an idiotic idea, yes.
Really? Why is that?
Well, people get attached to things they're familiar with. You know how that goes.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people said, "Well, the world doesn't need so many computers." People would say, "What could I possibly do with my own computer?" A Xerox senior manager said to me once, "If this is such a good idea, why isn't IBM working on it?"
We get those kinds of things a lot here too. So,
much later on, I don't know, in the past 10 years or so, there's a fellow at Harvard who's invented this phrase called disruptive technologies, and that's what happened in our case because we created some technologies that were not only disruptive to what Xerox was doing at the time, but these technologies were also disruptive to what IBM was doing at the time and what other computer manufacturers were doing at the time. So,
If they didn't think about it, you guys are not smart enough to come up with it on your own.
Well, that's part of it, but part of it is also they're being wedded to the products that they were then being successful with.
Yeah,
and
don't
so they're you know they're not willing to. Sort of back off and look at something that might be disruptive, and they suffer because of it oftentimes, sometimes fatally.
All right, we're going to come back to take a short break. Don't go away and come back and talk lots more with Bob Taylor, Charles Thacker, and Alan Kay. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flato. We're talking about the birth of the personal computer, the Internet, going back 30 years to Xerox PARC, where these pioneers worked on them. And with me are three winners of this year's Draper Prize, Robert Taylor, Alan Kay, and Charles Thacker. Three out of four. Butler Lamson is the fourth one. He's not with us today. Let me ask you, Alan Kay, how did the idea of a personal computer. You're credited with the idea of the personal computer. Was that a foreign concept also?
Well, it's when you talk about legends of Xerox PARC, there are many of them. This is one of them. My vote for the first personal computer was done by a guy by the name of Wes Clark in the early 60s, and the idea was around and especially became an important idea when we started trying to do interactive graphics using time-sharing systems. It was very hard to get the cycles of the big mainframe to the user when they actually needed them. And right at that time, there was a slow transition in the late 60s to more highly integrated circuits. And part of what we're celebrating today is a magic time in history, which was the turning point where integrated circuits became incredibly powerful in the hands of a few designers. And so I started working on one of a number of different desktop computers that people were playing around with in the late 60s. And for me, it was visiting some computing with children that Seymour Papert did that got me completely nuts about the idea of making a special little thing we call a laptop today for children that I call the Dynabook. And Bob had a very easy time recruiting me to PARC because he said, "Well, you can work on the Dynabook." And so I basically said, "Where do I sign up?"
would the Dynabook be called something like a PDA that we have today?
No,
describe it for us.
It looked like a basically the tablet computer that's mm-hmm. out. It had a screen that was big enough to do real work on. We call it an SVGA or an XVGA screen. It had a keyboard, and we made a cardboard model and put lead pellets in it and weighed it to see how heavy we could make it for before people didn't want to carry it around. The answer then was the same as the answer is today, which is about 2 pounds.
Right.
So you could think of something with a big enough screen and a keyboard and a pointing device somewhere between the kind of standard laptop of today and the much less useful PDAs.
Mm-hmm. And where was this device, the Alto, where did that fit into this?
Well, I think the, you know, I should say I'm completely thrilled to be included with these other three guys, because they were the three most important people at Xerox PARC, and they were the mainstream of the computing stuff there. And one of the most wonderful things, which wouldn't happen in just any place, was that any time they could help me, they did. And so the Alto was kind of a interesting summation, a combination of ideas that several of us had, ideas that Bob had, ideas that Butler Lampson had, ideas that Chuck Thacker had, and ideas that I had. And you know, Bob deserves the credit for putting together the environment that made us all smarter, and Chuck really deserves the credit for being able to take these disparate ideas and make something that each one of us could get some serious research done on. It was a breakthrough in many more ways than one.
Well, let me talk to Charles Thacker about that. What was your contribution here, do you think?
Well, I had actually met most of these people before going to PARC. We had worked together from a few years before when I was at the University of California. And initially, we built a time-sharing system. And about a year and a half after we set up the lab, we began to think about ways to improve the quality of the displays. And we tried several different things at PARC, but the Alto basically grew out of, as Alan said, the dramatic reduction in the price and increase in the density of semiconductor components. This is a thing called Moore's Law in the industry, and it's been with us now for 30 years. And Gordon Moore had stated the law 2 or 3 years before, and I think one of the things that we were able to do was internalize it faster than most people.
Yeah.
And the result of that was that for the first time it was possible to build a computer that was actually very small, relatively low powered, fit under your desk just the way a PC does today, but which would supply enough computing power to satisfy the needs of a single user, not multiple users as with a time-sharing system, but just one. And we were willing to spend what now would appear to be a tremendous amount of money to do that, something on the order of $10,000 to $15,000 per machine, but
a little more than that, I think.
Well, no, actually, we built a total of about 1,500 of these things, and they were sent out to universities, and there were Altos in use in the White House and Congress in like 1979.
Could they all talk to each other?
Yeah, by and large, yes. Not if they were separated by miles.
I see.
Then it was much slower because, remember, we still didn't have the high-speed network that we have today. We had only the telephone network, which was restricted at that time to about 50,000 bits per second.
Mm-hmm.
But within a building, we had the Ethernet, and that allowed the computers to communicate and send documents back and forth and send email and all the things we do today.
But you had to stay in the building.
You had to be within, well, typically within a campus.
Yeah,
because you had to wire it up yourself.
So, Bob, did you say this and say, hey, you know, why? You know, every building's got its own computer system. Why can't we hook them together?
Well, the ARPANET preceded Xerox PARC's founding by maybe a year in terms of when the ARPANET was actually up and running. I started the ARPANET project in 66, but it wasn't really up and running until 69, and PARC was founded in 70. So the ARPANET was sort of there, and within a few years at PARC, we got on the ARPANET, connected to the ARPANET. So we then had the first operational internet. An internet is the connection of two or more networks, makes an internet. So we had the Ethernet connected to the ARPANET. So if we're sitting in a lab in Palo Alto, for example, and this connectivity exists, we can send stuff to a colleague on the East Coast or wherever he might have his Alto and his Ethernet connected to an ARPANET. Am I being clear?
Yes.
Yeah. So from the beginning, we planned the Alto to be connected. The connectivity was vitally important. And you mentioned earlier I think Apple, one of the companies that took advantage by way of the Macintosh of what we did. But one of the things they missed was this important part of connectivity. So the first Macintoshes were not properly networked.
But the next generation, a few months later, were.
Eventually they got networked, but you could still quibble about the nature of the kind of networking that was initially applied to them.
Is that story about Steve Jobs coming there and seeing the idea and going home with it true?
Yes, but it was not a theft. A lot of people accuse him of stealing that stuff. In fact, Xerox corporate management had made a deal with him. They wanted to invest in his company, and he said, "Well, I'll let you give me some money if you'll let me come visit Park." and so that happened. I happened to be out of town the day that he visited, and I didn't know about any of its arrangements or anything. And it's probably fortuitous, because if I had been in town, I would have tried to throw him out of the lab.
Is that because you thought you had a good product there that Xerox didn't recognize on its own?
Absolutely. Yeah. Why give it away to somebody else?
So did you have to leave Xerox and go other places to get to go ahead with some of these ideas you were all thinking of?
Well, that's how those ideas finally got out. I mean, most of them, by various of our colleagues going off and either founding new companies or going to some existing company and showing that existing company how to utilize this technology.
It's amazing how often that happens, isn't it?
Yeah, well, right. It's back to what we were talking about earlier, I think, to some extent.
Let me take a phone call or two. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to David in San Diego. Hi, David.
How you doing?
Hi, go ahead.
I did a question or two, Bob. First of all, I got to congratulate all you guys for getting an award. You guys really deserve it. I'm a computer science student myself, and this question was, what do you guys think of the open source community, and do you see the future of that, or just your comments on that?
Okay.
Who's that addressed to?
Let me start with Alan on that one. Alan?
Well, I think the the ARPA community in the 60s was an open source community, and actually many vendors benefited from some of that code, and I felt that the difficulties of sharing when we were at Xerox PARC made it harder to work with our colleagues outside of ARPA. And to me, the way I think of it is, right now, if there's only a 1 in a million chance that somebody great in the world is going to work on your project for free, the internet can find about 300 of them now. Mm-hmm. And that's likely to be a tremendous force for at least balance, if not advancing the state of the art.
Mm-hmm. Bob?
This, of course, is not a simple issue. I mean, there's a question of if a company builds something, it has the right to claim ownership to it. And on the other hand, limiting the transportability of software limits developments in the field. So it's a double-edged sword. Mm-hmm. And I don't have any bias about it one way or the other, actually.
Charles Thacker, I think I know what you're going to say.
No, I don't think you do, actually.
I don't.
It has its strengths and its weaknesses.
Uh-huh.
The strengths are that smart people can collaborate around the world. The weaknesses are basically that people wind up doing it for basically no compensation. And that's not a way, unfortunately, in the modern world to make a living. Mm-hmm. So I think it will... You know, it has its place in many areas. I mean, certainly in the sciences, code is just shared by the community. But it also it's also somewhat unfair to ask people to work for no pay.
All right, David. Thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255. How have things panned out, gentlemen? 30 years. You know, you look ahead. Has all of this panned out the way that you thought it would? Let me start with you, Bob. Is the internet what you thought it would be? Doing things, you know, differently, or what would you like to see it do?
Well, if you would read that 68 paper that you referred to earlier, there's in it a description pretty much of an internet as we have it today. I mean, there are a lot of details that we didn't anticipate, but in general, we built the ARPANET to enable people who had access to interactive computers, which in those days were mostly timesharing systems, to share common interests over a network. And these interactive computers were earlier on at ARPA sites, and they were scattered in different places around the country, so you needed a wide area network in order to connect them. So, yeah, I think it's pretty much turned out the way we thought it would. In my case, it's turned out a lot slower than I thought it would, because the technology to enable the Internet pretty much existed by 1985, maybe even earlier. It certainly became affordable by 1985, but the Internet really didn't take off until 1995. So when people ask me to predict the future, I tell them I'm not any good at it, at least as understanding the timing of it. And also, I laugh when people tell me how fast technology changes and how it's hard for people to keep up with all of that. And I say, that's a bunch of nonsense. Technology creeps. Mm. The changes in technology take a very long time to get out into the real world. So, yeah, so I have a kind of a different outlook on that. Before I forget it, I'd like to, if you'll let me, retell a story that Butler told in his speech at the National Academy of Engineering Draper Prize.
Can I just jump in with a station ID here, and then you can go ahead?
Okay, sure.
I'm Ira Flatto, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, talking with my guest Butler, Charles Thacker, Alan Kay, and Bob Taylor, three winners of the Draper Prize. And Bob, go ahead, tell us about that story that Butler Lamson, the fourth recipient, was
saying. So he was talking in his speech the other night about sort of the intangible nature of software, and he told this story. I had never heard it before. I thought it was great, and if he were here now, I'd ask him to tell it. And the story goes like this. One day, there were a group of people who were writing the software for an early avionics computer that would go in an airplane. And one day they got a visit from the weight control officer who was responsible for the total weight of the airplane. And he says, you're building software? And they said, yes. How much does it weigh? Well, it doesn't weigh anything. Come on, you can't fool me. They all say that. No, it really doesn't weigh anything. So after half an hour of back and forth, well, he gives up, and 2 days later he comes back and says, I've got you guys pinned to the wall. I came in last night, and the janitor showed me where you keep your software. He opens a closet door, and there are boxes and boxes of punch cards. You can't tell me those things don't weigh anything. So after a short pause, they have to explain to him that the software is in the holes.
That's near and dear to my heart, because my first high school project was building a punch card reader.
Oh, you poor guy.
I got it to work. Let me ask you, Alan Kay, you say you were motivated by your desire for education and helping children out. Do you think the computer has, in these years, shown its potential to help kids in school and further education, or does it really not lived up yet?
Well, I think, I agree completely with Bob. I think starting around 1980, when commercialism of all these ideas happened, progress has gone to a crawl, and I think we're in this phase that McLuhan would have recognized of people who have less insight into what computers can do than the ARPA community, basically trying to automate the media of the past using bits instead of more physical materials. So, and certainly in education, there were some great people who had great ideas about what the computer could do for education, like Seymour Papert, and these ideas are right on as far as I'm concerned. And I've done work over decades with thousands of children that show that these ideas are right on. But it'll probably be another 20 years or more before any of these ways of helping children think better are adopted, if that. If you look at the...
Well, let me interrupt you, because we have to take another break. We'll come back and finish that thought with Alan Kay, Bob Taylor, and Charles Thacker, winners of the Draper Prize this year. talking about the past and future of computing, personal computing, the internet. Stay with us. More of your questions when we come back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour, reminiscing with three of the pioneers of personal computing, the internet, all people who were working at Xerox, Palo Alto Research Center, Xerox Park, back in the early days. Alan Kay, Charles Thacker, Bob Taylor, all winners of the Draper Prize this year. You know, one of the great prizes in engineering. Also, a winner was Butler Lampston. Butler Lampston is up in the air someplace. Couldn't be with us. We tried to get him on this hour so we can have them all on. And when I rudely interrupted, Alan Kay was talking about some of the trials and tribulations of trying to get education community to use computers correctly.
Well, I think there's two separate problems. One is that there have been many successful designs of much better curriculum, with or without computers, and the educational establishment has been very, very viscous about accepting any of these ideas. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a problem with or without technology. And one of the technologies that we thought was going to happen back in the 60s at some point that didn't happen was the computer as a semi-intelligent tutor. So this is one of the branches of what artificial intelligence was supposed to bring us, but in fact there are no real examples of a computer program that can take a piece of subject matter and gently help a learner learn that.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it's the hard problem is the flexibility part. So if I think you can imitate a bad teacher with a computer pretty well, because the bad teacher thinks that there's one answer and the kid's opinions don't count, and if the kid doesn't give that answer, then the computer can say no or the teacher can say no. But a good teacher is going to take into account the idea that the child has a mind and the child has motivations, and that if the child is thinking about something, the answer they come out with might be a variant, might be an interesting way of doing it. In music, it might be an odd phrasing, and a good music teacher will say, that's interesting, play the rest of the piece using that kind of phrasing, let's see what that sounds like. So the hard thing is to give the computer all of the extra side knowledge that a good teacher brings to bear for dealing with. In fact, this is a good metaphor for Xerox PARC, because the ARPA and PARC community that Bob Taylor set up was incredibly tolerant of variant ideas. So it wasn't just one lockstep master plan thing. It was a thing where people were continuously collaborating and having different ways of looking at things. And to me, that's a good educational environment. And it's just really, really hard to do that still on a computer. If you could, you could bypass the teachers and the parents to some extent by putting this self-teaching stuff out on the internet.
Interesting. Charles Thacker, where have things gone that you thought they would or wouldn't go?
Well, they've gone about as I thought they would, although it's taken a long time. I mean, recently I worked on the Microsoft tablet PC, which we thought we would all have in roughly 1980. But
and why didn't that happen?
Well, basically because of Moore's Law. But now we have that, and we're looking at ways to use it. And I actually disagree a bit with Alan. I think that the time for employing computers in education has come.
Oh, well, I agree with that, Chuck.
And in fact, that although we can't do some of the things that I think would be really great, there are a lot of things that we can do that will make things a lot better. I mean, consider foreign language instruction, for instance. These days, in a foreign language class, the teacher spends a tremendous amount of time teaching the kids to pronounce the language. And that can all be done today with a computer. Mm-hmm. But the ratio, and this is something that I've actually been working on at Microsoft. We're taking another look at this and how to do it. The problem is that the ratio of computers to students right now is about 1 to 5 in the United States. And that's not good enough. Every kid has got to have a machine, and that machine has got to be portable so that the kid can carry it around from class to class. It's got to last all day on its battery, which is something that no portable devices that our sufficient power can do quite yet. And it's got to do that, of course, because kids can't carry around the chargers. Business people carry around chargers with their laptops that only last 2 hours on a battery charge.
Well, the state of Maine gave every kid in Maine an iBook. And
yes, they did.
Very successful.
And it's been extremely successful. And we're learning a lot from that trial because they have begun to publish data about how well it works. And you have to remember that they don't yet have the core curriculum material on the computer. The kids still carry around textbooks.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, once you make that move, the core curriculum material can become much, much richer than we have today. So, in fact, educators like this idea a lot now. They're getting, I mean, it used to be that you would go in, and Alan actually did this. Alan put altos into one of the junior high schools in the Palo Alto area.
Over Xerox's dead body.
Well, yeah, but he did it and conducted a fairly extensive, what we now call a field trial of how this would all work, and the kids just loved it. They just loved it. And, of course, today, kids learn how to type in the third grade. Kids learn how to use Microsoft's Office suite at about the same time in order to, you know, do their assignments and so on. But I think once we get we get a device that is inexpensive enough that every kid can have one, and that's not quite there yet. You have to remember that education is a not very well funded part of our society.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a terrible shame, but it will happen. This is just inevitable.
All right, let me get a phone call in here before we have to go. Time is moving quickly. Anne in Walnut Creek, California. Hi, Anne.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Well, I've lost my nerves because these guys sound so wonderful. I just can't be negative.
Oh, know? Come on, give it a shot.
Well, I just feel I feel terrible because I love, you know, I'm an ex-programmer dating back to the days of the mainframe, and my last job was at the Harvard Computing Center. I left there in 1967 to have my first child. And
you need to update your resume, I think, a little.
Yeah, right. But you're right, exactly. But you'll never believe this, but I don't have a computer. I hate the direction that the computer business took. And
in what way? Tell us.
Well, I think I'll try to sum it up quickly. Well, actually, though, it isn't just me. I hate what it's done to our society. And of course, the more I've heard of your guests talking, I realize that mostly it's not their fault, and that
give us an idea. What has it done to our society
well,
that you?
Well,
hate
it
so
has dumbed it down.
Ah.
Because, but of course, this could have, this could have happened anyway, and that's not really related to my complaint about the use of a computer, but I would say that there is one point where my complaint and what it's done to our society intersect, and that's the graphical user interface. I don't think in chimpanzee pictures, and I don't think our society should. But at this point, I think it does to some degree. And I really think that was a bad way to go. I think in words, and I really think everybody should, and I think that the direction that things took should have been words, not menus, pictures, graphics,
well,
et cetera.
Well, let me play devil's advocate and say something, you know. Don't you think that the invention of the Internet, though, and email makes us all now type more than we ever had before?
Yeah, well, I don't think...
Write words and things?
Yeah, but what kind of words? And people, you know, people...
Well, I think,
you know,
let me break
honestly,
in.
I could talk for hours
all right,
about
let,
this.
Let me break in for a second,
yeah.
Because...
is that David?
This is Alan.
Alan, okay.
So the one of the most interesting things that didn't make it out of PARC... was why we did the graphical user interface, which is for children, precisely because we wanted to make it easier for them to program. And in fact, that whole system at Xerox PARC was scriptable, and the children learned about math and science by making simulations by programming.
Mm-hmm.
So when it came out, when you know the version that went to Apple got done, they decided they weren't going to make it programmable, and it wasn't until HyperCard that there was something that was a general media authoring tool, somewhat like what we'd done at Xerox PARC. So that was partly the low-pass filter of going to a vendor. And but the thing to realize is that we don't just think in words, and we don't just think in images. We also think in terms of muscular sensations. We have many different ways of thinking, and so an ideal computer in the future would also have some tactile feedback, as well as visual, as well as various ways to use symbols. So all of those things are things that are yet to appear in commercial devices, but we're completely within the purview, not just of us, but people who came before us, like Douglas Engelbart, the guy who actually did invent the mouse.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ann, for calling. We got about a few minutes left. Let me ask all three of you. Let me start with Bob. Where would you like the computer to go? Is a weakness you think that we need? What about the digital divide, where some people can't get computers?
Yeah, well, I think of the problems facing us in the future, that's the one that I care the most about.
Mm-hmm.
And Licklider and I in that 68 paper say something about that.
Mm-hmm.
Before I forget it, I want to point out that while this Draper Prize was given to the four of us, it actually was given for work done by about three dozen or so people, on the order of 50 people, worked over a period of about 8 years to build all the stuff that the prize honors. And we shouldn't miss an opportunity to point that out.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I could have imagined a few other names that could be attached to it.
Yeah, but once you start naming them, you're going to have to pretty
you're
much
make more enemies.
A very, very long list.
Yeah.
But you know, wouldn't you agree, Bob, that the power of PARC was the power of the community? It was just an incredible...
Yeah, sure. I mean, our colleagues... read like a who's who in computer science.
Are there centers still around with that creativity still being fostered?
I don't know of any.
I mean, I think of the past, Bell Labs as one other place, where that's gone also.
Los Alamos.
Well, I think Microsoft investment in their research community is pretty impressive. I mean, I know some of the people who are in Microsoft Research. Chuck Thacker and Butler Lampson are two of them. I know a number of others, and they're really extraordinary people. So I think Microsoft deserves some credit for keeping investment in research at a serious level.
Well, Chuck, I'll give you one last word.
Well, I think that's what Bob said is true. I mean, we've tried in Microsoft to build a relatively open laboratory. We communicate with and collaborate with academics throughout the world, publish papers just as if we were an academic department. So I think it's a little short-sighted to say that there is no more industrial computer science research. I think these things change, right? And it begins to look, from the experimental evidence, that really top great industrial labs have a run of about 20 to 25 years.
All right. Well, we've run out of time. I'd like to thank all of you. We could talk about this all day. And maybe we will have you all back if you want to come back and schmooze some more about this. I'm all for it. Let me thank Alan Kay, who's a senior fellow at Hewlett-Packard, Bob Taylor, founder and manager of the Computer Science Lab at Xerox PARC.
Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. Also, Director Emeritus of Systems Research Center at Compaq Computer Corporation. Charles Thacker, Distinguished Engineer, Microsoft Emerging Technology Group. All three of them, along with Butler Lampson, share this year's Charles Stark Draper Prize in Engineering, awarded by the National Academy of Engineering. Congratulations to all of you.
Thank you very much, Ira.
And have a drink for me on us.
Okay.
Our program is produced by Annette Heiss, senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our web producer. Our intern is Erica Altman. If you'd like to write to us, send email at serve over to sciencefriday.com. Also, free curricula there. Science Friday's Kids Connection is there, teaching materials that we make out of Science Friday. can also download back editions on your Audible.com player, your iPod, whatever, and once you get a subscription. Also, you can also look at the links we have up there for all our programming today, and also surf over to other sites that you may find interesting. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.